This is being recorded.
Wonderful. Well, welcome everybody. This is our second conference call for our M101, which is Manage Risk in Rural and Remote Communities. And I'd like to acknowledge that I'm hosting this call from the traditional territory of the Quanlin Dunn First Nation and Ton Quatrin Council. So as we usually do, we'll start today's call with a round of introductions, and then we'll move on to some of this week's content, which is a little bit more complicated because there's some steps in there. And then finally, we'll discuss risk management considerations for northern, rural, or remote communities, because we definitely have different considerations than what you might find if you took a course like this from down south. I think that that's an important discussion to have. For our round of introductions, maybe you could just introduce yourself. And I'm just wondering if, when you introduce yourself, you could share something, if there is something that stood out from you, or stood out for you from last week's content. And if there isn't, it's okay. You can just say pass. It could be a question that you still have. It could be something about how people perceive risk, 5 key areas of risk, or how you rate risk. So I'll just start, and that gives you a chance to think about the question. So I'm Caroline. I think everyone knows who I am. I'm based out of Whitehorse. And one of the things that stood out for me from last week, and I actually went and made slight wording changes, was that the interpretation of rating risk that I read through people's RLAs was, you guys were so on the ball, you rated the risk as if you'd already put controls in place. And so, not everybody, but some people did that. So I went back into the RLA and tweaked some of the wording a little bit. Because really when we rate risk, it's great to be able to look at an activity, but also break it further down. Lindsay did a really great job. She had a whole bunch of different ways that she broke down the risk for the exchange program into different areas and different categories, and some other people did that as well. And that helps you really drill down into what you can and cannot do with regards to the risk in your programs and activities. So that's something that stood out for me from last week. So let's go over to Eliza and then to Lindsay, Nadine, and Megan. Over to you, Eliza.
Okay, hi everyone, it's Eliza. I'm the wellness coordinator at the Canada Game Centre. I think for me, what I took away from the content for managing risk was actually Lindsay and I had a good conversation the other day while I was working on my assignment, and just hearing her view or how she creates her plans for her risk assessments for programs or events. It's just different than what I do in fitness, so I always appreciate learning what different people in different areas within recreation are doing, because recreation is all really diverse. So, you know, the way that I rate risk in fitness is very different from how you're going to rate an outdoor program or a special event, et cetera. So, yeah, anyway, I got a lot out of that conversation with Lindsay, and I think that it did help me when I was finishing my second assignment. So thanks, Lindsay.
That's great. Thanks, Eliza. Over to you, Lindsay.
So I'm Lindsay Agar. I'm the corporate events coordinator at the City of Whitehorse. And I think what I took out of that, and looking back onto my Ushiku program, is like, we've been very lucky over the last 35 years that this program has been running to not have any serious issues. But I think the thing that brought to the forefront was like COVID and international travel and everything that kind of has come from COVID, how it will affect and potentially change our program to not being what we are familiar with. So, yeah, it was one of those like reality checks where I'm like, are we ever going to send 10 kids to chaperones in international travel to Japan in the next 3 to 5 years? I don't know, but it made me think about it pretty hard.
Yeah, that's a good point to raise, because there's all sorts of things coming up, like there's a lot of major games coming up. So Arctic Winter Games next, I think it's the end of January, February, North American Indigenous Games, lots of different things. You know, people are going to want to travel again. People are going to want to go for conferences and things. So definitely, I think you hit out the nail there, Lindsay, that the ways that we do things in the future might not be quite the way we've done them in the past. So thank you. Over to you, Nadine.
Hi, I'm Nadine. I'm a youth recreation support worker for Kwamundun First Nation. And as far as, risk management last week, nothing jumped out at me in particular other than, like, my background prior to it has typically been in the guiding or, like, outdoor education-specific industries. So now going into rec, just looking at the differences of what kind of programs we're doing in a lot of the outdoor education and guiding, I think you could assume that it's a little bit, well, not assume, but just, like, I guess higher perceived risk or higher risk based on, like, you know, what sort of skills we're teaching versus recreation. So it was kind of cool to see these kind of rating, like, the green zone, amber zone, like, that kind of, like, look at rating and the difference kind of reflecting on what we've been doing in rec so far is the past. Yeah, it was just interesting.
That's great. It's nice to have that perspective from more of a guiding outdoor type approach because, you know, risk management and strategies to manage risk are definitely drilled into you when you have that background. And I think sometimes it's easy in recreation to sort of, you know, be a little softer, like make some exceptions because we want everyone to, you know, be involved. We want to make sure that we're inclusive and things like that. So, you know, I think perhaps where you come from is a little bit more rigid as far as, not rigid, but like pays a lot more attention to risk than what perhaps we do in recreation. And I think there's something to be learned from both. So thanks for sharing that, Nadine. Over to you, Megan.
Hi, I'm Megan Hashi. I'm a project coordinator with the Sport and Recreation Division with the Government of Nunavut. And I'm still catching up on this week and last week's content, so I'm going to go ahead and pass for this one.
That's great. Thanks for sharing that with us, Megan. That's important to recognize where we're at, and listening will actually really help you catch up, too. So, we shared some great ideas last week, and I know we'll have some good conversations today, too. So thanks for joining us today. So thanks, everyone. Last week, as you know, we talked about approaching risk management in a very disciplined way, using a series of steps. And that helps us not miss any of the key risks. We also found out that the risk of injury isn't the only type of risk we face. You might remember finishing up the phone call last week talking about different risks, and that's when Lindsay raised even the issue of a lost passport during an exchange program. So we have to make sure when we think of risk management that we think of environmental risks, reputational risks, property damages, privacy or a breach of security of data, you know, releasing people's private information, theft, loss. So there's a lot of other types of risk besides just a physical or psychological injury or damage that might occur. I think that's why it's really helpful breaking up an activity into different types or different concerns as you examine it and look and see where you can manage risk. Really, if we think about it, in reality, we can never get rid of or manage all the risks that we face. So instead, what we set out to do is to manage as much risk as possible before we start an event, or if we're partway through something like an activity or a program and we identify a risk that we weren't aware of before, we try and put something in place to address that risk so it doesn't continue. Last week, we chose an activity or event and rated the risks in a couple of different ways. So this week, what you're going to be asked to do is to identify some of the controls that can be put into place to manage or reduce the risks that you identified. Keeping in mind that the only way to completely eliminate risks is not to do anything. And seeing as recreation is about doing things, can never get rid of all the risk in recreation. So I'm going to start just by going through the three steps in the risk management process. And if you happen to have the slides open, this is shown on slide 16. So the three, oh, maybe not slide 16. Step one is on slide 16, which is rating the level of risk. And so we looked at that last week. And then once we've done that, we move into step two, which is shown on slide 24. And in slide 24, what we do is we do something called a risk audit. You can also think of it as a risk review. So what it does is we're identifying the major risks, and for all of those, we want to figure out controls that we can put into place. So think of a control as a strategy or an action or something that you would do to take the risk from maybe a gray zone down to a green zone or from a 12 down to a 9. And then what we do is we actually reassess the risk assuming these controls are in place. So I think what some people did in their activities last week is they said, well, I'm going to run, let's say, an after-school program, and I will make sure that I already have the right right ratios for supervisors in place. I'll make sure I have an emergency response plan, things like that. But some of those are already the controls. So you actually jumped into, I already know what I need to do to manage risk, and this is what the residual or remaining risk is. But really, there's times where we're dealing with something new or a new location or a new group of people. So the way you would do a program with preschoolers might not be the same way you would do that program with elementary school children. So then your risks might be different in your assessment of those risks. So slide 24, the step two, is really important to figure out those major risks, identify the controls, and then assess this residual risk. Slide 25 is just a reminder of the five key areas that we're looking at risk in, and so that's a good one to sort of keep in the back of your mind so that we don't miss any of those areas. And then slide 26 gives you some questions of how you can sort of identify any gaps. So you can ask yourself, for example, do I have a good ratio of supervisors to participants? What equipment needs to be inspected before I let anyone use it? Do I have checklists in place for opening the facility? Those sorts of things. And those will help you identify, have you done a good job of thinking through what the risks are? You can actually, the things that are on the slides are also in the risk management handout, so you can find those throughout the risk management handouts, and you can download that and use it or adapt them as well. Slide 27 shows you sort of the steps in completing this review of risk. So as you did last week, the first thing is to describe the major risks. The second thing that you also did last week would be to rate each risk. And now this week we're looking at those controls, as I said, and then we're assessing what remaining risk or residual risk is. So before I move on, let me just ask, actually I'm going to talk about residual risk and then I'm going to ask if you have any questions, because to me this is the most complicated piece. And the reason I think it's actually complicated is because this is something we all do naturally, that we don't necessarily think about it. So, for example, there's a risk when you cross the road. We don't usually think of the risk, and we might automatically look for cars before we cross the road. So because, you're more experienced in your roles in recreation, breaking this apart into a thought process of smaller steps is sometimes actually harder to do when you have this experience than when you're new to it. So don't worry if it feels like this is kind of complicated. But I just wanted to mention that residual risk is shown on slide 28. And what the concept of residual is, it's the same as leftover risk. And so you can imagine that put controls in place or you put a number of supervisors, but there's still some risk left over. And then you have some questions to ask. So before we jump into some questions, I just want to ask, does anyone have any questions about step one, which is identifying the risks and rating the risks, or step two, which is about thinking about what you can do and how much that would reduce the risk? So I'll just go around in the same circle. Eliza, any questions or even suggestions or comments about those first two steps?
No, I don't have any questions or comments. I'm good.
Okay, great. And does it make sense to you, because you've done this for a while, it's probably part of how you naturally work. Does it make sense that it seems strange maybe to break the steps down further because you kind of would just flow into what you should be doing?
Yeah, that was part of the conversation with Lindsay that I had, was that it was, for me, when I had to do the assignment, I was already jumping ahead in my planning to kind of those next steps. So to kind of get my brain to slow down and try to think of it from a different angle or a different perspective, which is good. But yeah, you get into your own little routine of how you plan it or how you would assess or manage risk. So yeah.
Yeah, and so it's good to recognize that in yourself. What that also tells me is that this sort of process might be really useful for you when you're working with new staff or when you're working with new leaders. So if you're working with somebody that's new to what you're doing, you're just training them or something like that, being able to break this down rather than naturally assume that they will know how to assess risk and rate it and what to do, I think then it's really helpful too. So just,
yeah,
you know, if you have staff, yeah, if you have staff you supervise, this can be a great thing to work through with them. So thanks, Eliza. Lindsay, do you have any questions or anything to share about your thoughts with regards to the step one and step two of the risk management process?
I think for me, I don't really use the word control. I say mitigation a lot. So it's like, this is the risk. This is how it goes. This is how we're going to mitigate it, how we're going to make certain that it's not going to be at that level. So that was one thing that I think about commenting on. And then the other is, I like how you've laid it out. I really like the end result where you're like, okay, yeah, there's still risk, and we've done all these things, and it's low. But you could also have, you've done all these things, and it's still moderate. So it's one of those things, do I want to do that thing as part of my program or not? So it was just really interesting. I was like, oh, that's a good step. I like the last part.
Yeah, exactly. And that sort of end result ties into actually one of our other risk management learning events, the legal risk, which talks about four different ways to approach risk. And one of them is to avoid it by canceling what you're doing because there is too much risk. Another one is to simply accept it. Another one is to do what we're doing, which is to manage it. And then the fourth one is to transfer it, which is what you do when you have insurance and waivers and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's really important to recognize that there's different ways, even with that end result, as you pointed out, there's different things you can do with that end result. So thanks. And I like the word mitigate, because mitigate doesn't mean eliminate, right? It's not the same thing. So it means reduce as much as we possibly can. So good word to use. Thank you. Nadine, how about yourself? Do you have any comments on the step one and two of the risk management process? Any thoughts or anything that you know, you could share from your perspective?
Yeah, no comments really. This actually looks really familiar to a lot of what I've used in the past when we were doing this stuff for guiding and stuff. So it actually looks like crazy similar, which is kind of neat. But no, nothing really. To me, like, this is just a really nice way, like, especially say you don't, if people haven't done much risk management or thought about it in such a, like, specific and kind of, like, step-by-step way, I think this is a really great resource to kind of think of those things. But, yeah, I think kind of like Eliza, too, like, if you've done it a lot, it's easy to kind of do it all in your head without breaking it down so specifically.
Yeah, and that's great. I think that's a good learning thing because we have a variety of different people taking our are learning events, right? So we might have people that, you know, are 17 and just entering the field of recreation and might not know how to go through this process. That might seem overwhelming to them. And then for those of us who've done this for a long time, it's like, oh yeah, I know how to do this. Like, I have never broken it apart before. I just do it because it's part of what I do, right? That sort of risk management becomes part of who you are and the field that you're in. So thanks for sharing that, Nadine. Megan, how about yourself? Do you have any questions or thoughts or anything about steps 1 or 2 or the process of risk managing risk in general?
No, not right now. I'm just taking the time to listen and absorb it all. Thanks.
Awesome, thanks. And I did just hear a beep, so I'm wondering if somebody else joined the call.
Hi, Caroline. It's Joanne Weedmark. Unfortunately, I had some internet issues, so I couldn't call in, but I'm here now. Thanks.
Great. We're glad you could join us, Joanne. And living in the North, we all understand internet and phone issues, so no worries. Happens to us all the time. There was one day we actually had a learning event, and all the Northwest landlines were down everywhere. So, you know, that's not what we usually expect. So these things happen. We're just on slide 28, and we've been talking about the first 2 steps of the risk management process, and we've just got to the point of talking about residual risk. So I'll just move on from there. And then I'll get everybody to say their name when we come back around, just so you feel part of the circle as well. So let's take a moment. We're going to dig a little bit more into this idea of residual or leftover risk. I've got 3 questions for you. They're actually on the conference call slide, which is slide 31, if you want to find them there. And I will also post them in the chat and read them out. And they're on slide 28, sorry. And I'm just wondering about if we can go around in our circle. You don't have to comment on all of the questions. Just pick a question and share your thoughts about it. So my questions are, if you think about residual or leftover risk, you want to ask yourself, what actually influences how much risk is acceptable, how much risk is okay, and who decides how much is acceptable? So let me pop those questions in the chat, and then I'll just read them once more. And if you don't mind, we'll just go in the same order that we have our circle going. So I'm sorry, Eliza, I'll put you on the spot again just at the beginning. So here, let me pop it in the chat so you can see the question though. Okay, there we go.
Yeah, no worries. So I can, do you want me to go ahead?
Yeah, so just think about and comment on 1 or more of these questions. What influences how much risk is acceptable? How much risk is okay, or who decides how much risk, what amount is acceptable?
I'll introduce myself again, I think. So hi, I'm Eliza from Whitehorse at the Canada Game Center. So I think what influences how much risk is acceptable can vary, I think, depending on the type of organization or company or nonprofit that you work for, depending on if you're bound by policy or you have different working processes or things that you're bound by, bylaws and such things. How much risk is okay? I think for recreation, I think, you know, we don't want to be getting into that. This is, you know, my personal opinion is, you know, we're not getting into that, like, really high range of risk. But I think it depends on the type of program as well and all those other factors that come into it. If you have a high-risk program but you have proper training and you have all of those emergency plans in place and those types of things, that maybe a higher risk is acceptable. And I think who decides that, it would be you know, the supervisor or manager along with the staff who are facilitating the program. I think that it's really important for the staff who are actually going to be facilitating to be involved in as much of that kind of risk assessment plan as possible, since they're the ones that are going to be leading it and putting maybe themselves at risk as well.
Right, and I mean, that's COVID alone, as Lindsay raised earlier, is a good example of that, right? Like a risk that perhaps is higher for your staff than even for your participants. So thanks, Eliza.
Yeah.
Lindsay, what are your thoughts on one or more of these questions, whichever ones you wanted to touch on? What influences how much risk is acceptable? Who decides what amount is acceptable? Or how much risk is okay? They're kind of the same sort of questions, just worded differently.
It really resonated with me is how much risk is okay. The worst part is it depends. It depends on your participants, your training, your organization, your weather, your location, your participant's comfort level, your legal rights to them. Have they signed waivers? Are they waivers that they've understood, read, or have read to them to sign off on? Are they the right people to be signing those waivers? Right. So it always depends. I find as a CFO course, we are very risk averse. We don't like to take on a lot of risk. We either like to transfer it to somebody else through waivers, or we try to give it away. We don't necessarily want to keep a lot of risk in our programs and whatnot. So, yeah, I think for me, it's like how much risk is okay. It just depends on who your people are, what you're doing, and where you're doing it, and how you're doing it.
Right, and that's a good sort of lead back to the five key risk areas, because when you're looking at your controls, there's things that you can do to reduce that risk and reduce, you know, when you're a risk-averse organization, reduce the risk through certain controls, right? So, yeah, this is where the answer definitely is. So thank you for that. Nadine, any thoughts on these questions? You know, how do we know how much risk is acceptable? Who decides if it's acceptable? How much is okay?
Yeah, well, I think, like, what influences how much risk is acceptable is an interesting question because, I mean, we can look at risk for ourselves and assess that, but there's a difference between, like, perceived risk and actual risk. For example, you know, if you're at a high ropes course with somebody that is terrified of heights, their perceived risk is going to be a lot higher than what maybe the actual risk is. And so I think it's an interesting question, and depending on what kind of programs, like, do participants get to choose how much risk that they're okay with, and things like that. So I think it's an interesting question. Because we can do a lot of things to mitigate risk, especially like a high risk course is quite a safe activity, but there's a lot of exposure and things that a lot of participants aren't used to, which will make their perception of the risk a lot higher than what is actually there. So it's like a really interesting question. And I think like whenever doing maybe like activities that may be perceived as riskier, even though maybe the risk is actually, like, well mitigated, it's kind of nice to kind of approach with a group and say, well, where is your risk line? Where is your risk tolerance? And make it kind of a group decision so that people can kind of, you know, decide for themselves how much risk is acceptable. But it's an interesting question because there's definitely, like, a wide gap of what people can perceive as risk.
Exactly, and that just brings us back to our conversation of last week, right, where, you know, we started talking about how even in your own organization, if you're working with coworkers, each of you may perceive that risk differently. So what you're suggesting is that it extends to your participants as well, and it's really important to recognize those differences in how we see risk in our lives. And, you know, somebody might be quite comfortable with risk in an outdoor environment, but not comfortable with, putting out money for, you know, good equipment that will keep them safe or something. Like there's lots of different ways that people approach it. So thank you for pointing that out. Megan, any thoughts on sort of this, you know, how much risk is acceptable or how much is okay and who makes those decisions?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with what everyone else has said, where there's variables and it definitely depends on a bunch of different factors. But, like, working with
a territorial government, we try to aim for like as little risk as possible. I mean, we have a lot of people depending on us, and we have a lot of people watching us. So it's really important to make sure that we're taking care of anything that we can, and like being accountable for our actions. So like if I was working for like a nonprofit or a pub or a private business, you definitely want to try not to have too much risk, but it's definitely not the same when you're working with like a governing body and stuff.
Exactly, and I mean government, especially a territorial government, is set up to manage a certain level of risk anyways, right? Like there's a large financial risk when you put money out through sports and recreation grants and contributions, and there's a large risk when you take a team to Arctic Winter Games or to North American Indigenous Games. So there are different risks, and fortunately in somewhere like government, there's so many policies in place, and I think Eliza mentioned policies right at the beginning that can help sort of put guidelines in place about what's acceptable and what's not. Sometimes it's hard to find them all, but that's great. And thank you for raising that comparison. I think that that's really important. So, Joanne, not to put you on the spot, you can pass if you want, but I'm wondering if you'd like to just reintroduce yourself to everybody who's on the call. And if you feel like it, we're just talking about what influences how much risk is acceptable, how much is okay, and who decides.
Hi, I'm Nisekwa, everyone. My name is Joanne Wiesmark, and I am the Recreation Director here in Kinyite, formerly known as Cape Dorset. So how much risk is acceptable? So from a supervisor's perspective, that can be a difficult question sometimes, and I'll just quickly use an example here. I work for a nonprofit here in my community, and there's a certain bylaw for policies and procedures for risk management, and again, from a supervisor's perspective, I'll use this as an example. For example, if we had a youth program to go out hunting and hired a few local hunters to take the youth out, we would have to measure, okay, is this acceptable? Can we take the risk? But then we also have to look at, okay, is there proper supervision with the youth? Are the instructors qualified? And is there instructions? Is there lesson plans for staying out on the land? Are the instructors trained? Are they qualified, again? And for, like, risk facilities, equipment, like, for example, if there's skidoo rope down, that's a risk out on the land with a number of youth. So is there proper inspections and maintenance on the equipment? And if anything were to happen to a youth, is this program documented, like, anything written down out on the land? Is there emergency response plans, drills, or anything like that? Or any communication devices, GPSs, or anything like that. So I just wanted to use that as an example, looking at the risks, just using the program as an example, looking at the number of risks. So it can be a difficult question from a supervisor's perspective, but following the policies and procedures of risk management, I think some risks are acceptable, but we just have to measure how much risk we're taking. Thank you.
That's great. Thanks. That's a really good example, like on the land programs in remote settings, especially in the winter if we're talking about skidoos, have a lot of risk in them. But, you know, you just mentioned a number of different things that you would make sure that would be in place, and so that would take – if those weren't in place, your assessment of risk or your rating of risk would be very high, probably in the red zone. But by putting different things in place and looking at the different key areas of risk, then showing us how you can even put policies in place, right, to help reduce risk in the program so that the level of risk that you're coping with is more acceptable. Because we don't want to stop doing programs in recreation. Like, that's not the point of recreation. So thanks so much for sharing that, Joanne. I think, you know, coming back to residual risk, I think I just mentioned that there's really four options if our risk is too high. Like, if our residual risk, we still feel it's too high, and that's to cancel a program. So a good example that I have from the north would be when there's weather. So, you know, a lot of schools, a lot of recreation programs have a cutoff temperature. So then you would cancel if you couldn't reduce the risk because the weather was too cold, for example. You could accept the risk and go ahead and run the program and keep your fingers crossed. And doesn't mean something bad's going to happen. It just means that it's a little riskier. You could figure out other ways to manage it. So maybe if it's outdoors and it's cold and you still want to run it, you set up warming huts, you hand out warmer clothing, or you have more supervisors, or you make sure you're closer to a building that you can go inside when you need to. So you might look at what your plan is and see what else you could do in that situation. And then the other one is that we've mentioned would be put waivers and insurance and things like that in place to transfer the risk. And when you talk about hiring or contracting instructors, particularly experts maybe in outdoor settings like rock climbing or something like that, or on the land programming, that's another way of transferring risk. You're getting somebody who's an expert or has specialist training as well. So one of the things for us in the north, and I'd like to have this conversation before we wrap up the call. My apologies, I missed step three. I was talking about step one and step two, and step three is on page 29, and it just suggests that you do an action plan. I think most of you will be familiar with how you lay out an action plan. It's sort of look at your risk area. Is it around your participants, your supervision, your equipment, your emergency response, and what will you do, who will do it, and when will they do it by? And so that's just a simple plan. It's nice to be able to put that into writing, because if you're working as a team, then you know that somebody's tasked with it and it will get done. So that's, putting what we're going to do in writing is really helpful. And actually documenting things, as Joanne mentioned, is actually a good risk management strategy. So let's just take a look. We're going to look at some of the special considerations that we face in the north. And some of these are listed on slide 30, but we can dig into these in a bit more detail. I just mentioned weather. There might be some other things too. So I will pop this question in the chat, and I'm just going to ask it, and feel free to listen, pass, or share your thoughts on this. So the question is, and maybe we won't put Eliza on the spot. Nadine, can I start with you for this round of our circle? And the question is, what are some special risk management considerations in our communities in the north, and what makes recreation in our communities riskier, and what can we do to manage these types of risks? So that's a really big question. Just you can pick something that you wanted to touch on. It could be one of the risks listed on slide 30, which are around travel, alcohol, organizational structure, food, weather. There's a number of things. So let's start with you, Nadine.
Yeah, so I think in the north, weather and environment are really big risk factors here, especially in the winter. It's not uncommon to have temperatures below minus 30, which at that point it's just really too cold to do anything with kids. And even, warmer than that, even minus 20 can be kind of pushing it depending on the activity. So I would say, weather conditions, most of the winter it can be challenging. Even in the summer, things can be cold. And I'd also say wildlife, even within Whitehorse, there are lots of bears around and moose and wildlife. So I think these are definitely some risk factors that maybe you wouldn't be thinking about downtown Toronto. Something that's unique to the north.
Very true. And what is one thing that you might put into place to manage, whether it's the cold, the summer weather, or the wildlife? What's something that you might do in your program? What's this action or a strategy that you would put into place?
Yeah, so for weather, I mean, us, we do have a cutoff of what's acceptable to bring kids outside, and also how much time, like, we've also calculated, like, if it's this temperature, kids can spend this much time outside at this temperature. And so there's, like, a couple of different factors and scenarios. So we follow that. We also, you know, if we know we're doing outdoor programming, we have all the winter gear here that we can provide to any participants that may not have it. It's not uncommon that kids don't have proper winter boots or coats or snow pants, mitts, anything. So we make sure that, like, we have that for pretty much any size, to make sure that we can give that. And then as far as wildlife goes, so we make lots of noise. We have multiple cans of bear spray, and we definitely manage our group sizes. And we also have a really large, like, leader-to-participant ratio. Like, for example, for a group of 10 kids, like, we'll have 4 leaders. So to make sure that we're able to manage the group well, especially when we're going out into the forest. Like, we're up here in McIntyre and Whitehorse. The forest is right there, and it's very common to have bear sightings. So we've always, you know, we'll have multiple first aid kits, multiple cans of bear spray, and organize leaders at the front and the back and kind of the middle, so that there's no possible chance that any kids, you know, kind of wander off.
That's great. Thanks. So some really good strategies, some around your emergency responses, some around your written policies about, you know, when you might cancel a program. And then some clothing really, to me, falls under that equipment support sort of piece. So thanks for sharing that, Nadine. Megan, thinking of maybe, you know, your experience in the north, so maybe not with forests and black bears, but maybe other risks, what are some of the special risk management considerations in and around your community related to recreation?
Yeah, again, it also has a lot to do with, like, the weather and the conditions and stuff like that. Something else I thought of was being aware of any, like, community events. So for, because our communities are so small, like, you kind of don't want to interfere with anything else that's going on. So, for example, if there's, like, a funeral, or if there's a bingo night, then you don't really want to have things going on at the same time, just because you know those things are where the majority of the people are going to be. And then also something else with travel is our planes have mechanical issues a lot. So if we're taking a team somewhere, we have to be very aware that our flight being canceled because mechanical issues or whatever is a very real possibility.
Well, what are some of the things, like, those are really good examples. I mean, the community one really speaks to that we have to keep in mind of different types of risks. So the risk, in my mind at least, related to hosting a program, like a recreation program, when there's something else like a funeral going on, is, you know, it can hurt people. Like, it can be, I guess, maybe damaging to your reputation. It can it can mean that you put money into something that then you don't recoup, or something like that. Maybe you can explain, Megan, from your perception, what the risks actually are related to that, and how you would put something in place. Like, say you had somebody new come and work in your community. How would you explain that to them or manage that type of risk?
Yeah, it definitely has to do with, like, the reputation. And then, like, you also want to be sensitive for those types of issues. Again, small town, everybody talks and stuff. And, yeah, you also don't want to put all your time and energy into an event and then have nobody show up. It's not, like, you can't always reschedule those types of things. So you really do need to pay attention to current events and make sure that it's not interfering anywhere else.
Yeah, maybe even having a written policy, right? So for your organization,
yeah.
That if something arises in the community, that your choice will be to counsel, you know, in these types of circumstances or something like that.
Yeah, usually if there's an event that's happening at the same time as something else like that, they'll go directly to the family and ask for permission whether or not to continue their event.
That's great. So that's sort of a, you know, maybe for the most part unspoken, but in bigger areas perhaps needs to be written down, right? Or for people who are coming from outside to work in your organization. Thanks, Megan. Those are some really important ones to raise. Joanne, how about yourself? You're in a different community in Nunavut. Are there any other sort of special risk management considerations? Like you've mentioned about going out on the land. Are there other things that come into mind, whether you're running recreation in your community, in your facilities, or outdoors on the land?
Yeah, so I'll use another example. If we have like a sport event where we have kids public skating or playing at the gym, we try to make sure we're using the proper equipment. For example, helmet or elbow pads or knee pads. Just making sure we're taking care of that properly too, and making sure we have staff on site. Because again, being in a small community is not easy. For if an incident were to happen during our sports, and then the youth had to be sent out and the weather wasn't nice, so just always trying to be safe, looking at the looking further ahead. So that's one example. The community, we don't always have planes either, or we have a health center, but we don't have doctors or anything, so if anything were to happen, like a youth got hurt, they'd have to be cleaning out. And again, if we were to have like teams going out for sport tournaments, we would also have to consider like the delays or the cancellations as mentioned earlier. So yeah, I agree. Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah. And I mean, for those of you in the Yukon, you can imagine how Nunavut is very different to us. You have one fly-in community and the rest are all accessible by road year-round, as compared to in Nunavut where, you know, they're all fly-in or accessible for a couple months a year by boat, and that's about it. So quite a different context, which definitely brings some other risk management considerations. And, you know, when you're in a region where weather can come in very quickly, and, you know, and planes can be grounded for 2-3 days, you definitely have to think that through and have some strategies in place for if that occurs. So thank you both, Megan and Joanne, for sharing that. Let's come back to Eliza. Eliza, what are some other special risk management considerations for recreation in our northern communities, and what might we do to manage them?
I always think about the communication, and that a lot of times our cell phones aren't reliable. So if we're taking groups outside of a facility, that we have two points of communication. So a lot of times I'll use our kids triathlon, for example, which half of that triathlon is in the facility or part of it, so using the pool. But then the rest of the event is outside and out on the trails surrounding the Canada Game Centre and Mount Mac area. So we have our radios, which we use to keep track of all the kids who are participating in the event. But we also use our cell phones so that, one, we're not clogging up our radio channels in case we do have an emergency, but that we also have the backup as a cell phone, and we have key people who will have a cell phone and a radio, and then the majority of the rest of the staff or volunteers that just have radios.
Right, so that communications, I mean, that's integral in whatever you happen to do and wherever you go, and I think that that awareness of what you need for what you're doing is so, such an important part of planning. And as we all know, that can break down. We can lose access to the internet. We can lose cell phone access. We can lose landline access. So hopefully you've got those backup radios. So, thanks, Eliza. Lindsay, is there anything else that comes to mind as far as sort of bigger special risk management considerations?
For me, I think for my larger events, I always think about access control and specifically how am I going to get an ambulance into an event and how are they going to get to the person that is injured. So for me, large crowds of thousands, well, in the past it was 1,000 people, how do you manage that? How do you get them in? How do you get them out? Also, in this day and age, thinking it's pretty dark, but some people become fanatical and where are you going to put CRCMP and if there's a bomb threat or there's a loose shooter? Like, those are things that I now think about more and more for my larger scale events and how it's different in the Yukon because we don't have the resources like you would see in Vancouver to address some of these issues and making sure that they're part of our emergency plans early on when we do large scale events. So they know what's happening, how they're going to access Shipyards Park, or are they going to leave Shipyards Park both in case of anything happening. So, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's definitely something that, you know, the Yukon, I think, is the fastest growing population across the country over the last 5 years. So more and more people, and once things relax, post-COVID, but as we move forward, you'll probably have a lot of those concerns again. And so thank you for sharing that. Some of the other ones that are listed on slide 30 are definitely, you know, travel being mentioned with regards to planes, but also land travel. If you're traveling for sports events or things between communities where you might have roads, or if, in the case of Nunavut, if you're traveling outside your territory as well. Alcohol, and I guess you can add in cannabis to that one, are also special considerations. The challenge with that is that the rules are different in each territory. And then also, you know, when you're serving alcohol or allowing alcohol at a recreation event, that's a whole other level of risk management, brings a whole additional element in itself too. So I think you guys have done a great job with touching on a number of different things that come into risk, or managing risk in recreation. It's been really interesting having you on the call, those of you who work more inside facilities, those of you who work with special events, those of you who work outdoors, those of you who work in communities or for governments. So thank you very much for sharing all your experiences. And what I'd like to just mention before we end the call is that your final required learning activity is due on Sunday, and there is a template you can use if you want to. I've also linked to a plan that someone from MetroCo created, that's in the NWT. I don't feel that you have to create such a detailed plan. I think I mentioned last week that if you have coworkers that you're taking this learning event with and you would like to work on a plan together, you can do that. Just let me know so that I'm not waiting for something from somebody else and they've helped you with the one that you shared. After we complete the call and when you do your required learning activity, please remember that we have a feedback form, which is number 8. And there's also, if you haven't done it, a quick, how do you feel about risk now, which is number 6. It's just a quick question and click the answer. So if you could do that as well. Next week, you get a break. So no conference call next week. And for those of you who are moving on with us, RP 101, which is Plan for Success, begins on March 14th. NWT and Nunavut will change clocks before then, but your conference calls are on the same time as what they are right now. It's Yukon, so those of you in the Yukon, we have to start wrapping our head around the next conference call is actually at 10 in the morning for our time rather than 11, because when everyone else changes, we go back to Pacific time. So I will make sure I make that pretty obvious as well. So if you have any questions, please remain on the line after I stop the recording. Thank you. Masicho, merci, Nathanique, Kwana, thanks for joining today.
Thank you.